Justice Reform Committee, and on behalf of Chair Considine, who chairs the Corrections Committee, I officially want to call this committee to order. Today's item of business is simple in that it's only one, but it's not simple in that it's a good opportunity to do a deep dive into a highly important issue that brings complexity, but also good opportunities for this body and for the people of Minnesota. We're going to be hearing from the Office of the Legislative Auditor their report on prison safety and security. And for the public, there are copies of the report outside. So if you haven't gotten one, feel free to obtain one. And I suspect there are copies of the report also online at the Legislative Auditor's website. Let me just make a couple of very brief remarks. And by the way, what we're going to do, if it's okay with you, Chair, is to hear from the legislative auditors straight through. And then subsequent to that, we'll hear from the Commissioner of Corrections. And then I'll ask both of them to remain at the witness table, and then we'll open up for questions and answer. Just some very quick thoughts on my part. One is that it's absolutely appropriate that the state reflects its commitment to all Minnesotans, each and every one Minnesotans, when it comes to the issue of safety. We have Minnesotans that are committed to our state prisons as a consequence of their actions and as they go through our criminal justice system. But in my mind, that does not relieve us of a responsibility that we have to all residents in the state of Minnesota, which is to work to ensure that their personal safety is enhanced and promoted. The other thought, quickly, members, is that as I anticipated the office doing this this study, there was some conversation that kind of generally out here that we should only look at safety issues relative to one population that exists within our facilities. And a number of us early on voiced the importance of not doing that false dichotomy of human beings inside our facilities. The safety of our staff, our correction officers, are vitally important, and the safety of our residents in the facilities are also vitally important. And I strongly suspect that, in fact, their safety is mutually intertwined. And so, for me, this is more than just a moral construct, although it is that. I think it's also very practical understanding of how we promote safety in whatever community shape has. And then a final thought, members, and think about this, please, as you engage with our presenters in questions, is for me just to share how proud I am of this committee and our work last year, where even prior to this report, we made some very strong commitments to properly, as best as we could, fund the infrastructure needs of our state facilities. Many of those investments tied to this notion of safety. Frankly, I wish I could say that that same commitment existed over in the other body, but as we saw from their report from their bill coming forward, it certainly did not reflect that. And so I hope that as we engage in a good, honest, tough exchange here, that that we also remind ourselves of the importance of maintaining that strong commitment as we did last year. So, members, some of you, I'm going to out him. I haven't told him this. Some of you are aware that good colleague, Representative Considine, made a public statement yesterday. And I just want to acknowledge his pending retirement from our body. Chair Considine, I have to say, it's been a privilege, truly, to work with you, to learn from you, and to take your guidance as we do this work. And personally, you're going to be terribly missed in this body. And I thank you for your service to the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Chair, and I would just say that it's a mutual admiration. And so pleased to have had the opportunity to work with you. And Chair Johnson, sorry, Representative O'Neill's not here. The members on the minority that are on my committee have been a joy to work with. And, of course, the team on our side, too. So.
Thank you, Chair Considine. So with that, we're going to dive right in. We'll begin with a presentation from the Office of Legislative Water. And again, members, we'll have them go through their report. We'll then hear from the commissioner, and then we'll open up for questions and answers. And so please welcome to the committee and state your name for the record and share your information with us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Judy Randall. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor for OLA's Program Evaluation Division. And we are very pleased and grateful to be able to be here today to discuss our report on safety in state correctional facilities. I do want to thank both Chair Mariani and Chair Considine and all of you for convening this joint meeting on this really important topic. As the chair talked about, managing the state's correctional facilities is a very important responsibility. And a big part of that, of course, is ensuring the safety of both the prisoners and the staff who work there. As Mr. Kirchner will explain, we found a number of conditions that frankly reduce the safety in state prisons. One of the things we found as we worked through our evaluation is that the data the department collects is not very reliable or useful for us or for them to measure safety in state prisons. So certainly we worked with it and did what we could, but additionally we did what we always do, but I think we did even more of it, and I want you to know kind of the work that went into this report. Because we didn't feel confident in the data for a lot of purposes, we did a lot of extra primary data collection is what I would call it. We, or the team, visited 9 of the 11 prisons across the state. In 4 of them, the 4 with the highest security levels, so St. Cloud, Stillwater, Rush City, and Oak Park Heights, they were basically embedded in those facilities for 3 days. And on those tours, if you will, they toured the facilities, they went on rounds with folks, but they also talked with dozens of people when they were at the facilities. They interviewed lieutenants and leadership at the prisons. They interviewed corrections officers and non-uniform staff, and they also interviewed prisons. They also talked with prisoners, thank you. They looked at the prisons, they interviewed the prisoners, and they also, you know, talked with people as they were passing them in the hall and really got a nuanced feel of what was going on in those prisons. Additionally, the team conducted 2 surveys. They conducted a survey of prisoners in medium security or higher settings, and they also conducted a survey of prison staff that routinely interact with prisoners.
Could we use residents instead of prisoners?
We can use whatever term you'd like, Mr. Chair, but I didn't catch
that.
It.
Residents.
Residents, absolutely. Thank you. Based on our kind of on-the-ground methods, the site visits, the interviews, the surveys, we were able to get a very rich and nuanced look into security at the state's correctional facilities. And because of that, we have a lot for this committee and for the department to consider when thinking about security at the state correctional facilities going forward. I'd like to now turn to Mr. Kirchner, who is the evaluation of the was the manager of the evaluation. Sorry, I'm all discombobulated today. I'd like him to walk through our findings and recommendations in more detail. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Terrific. Welcome, Mr. Kirchner, to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Chair. And I will try to respect the Chair's request to use the term residence. I've practiced with a different word, and so if I slip up, I hope you'll forgive me. And I can't change the slides at this point. I'm going to talk about kind of five key concerns I'm going to work my way through in this presentation. As Ms. Randall noted, we have some concerns about poor data and the lack of information available. I want to talk about staffing shortages, which has been a significant issue at a number of facilities. I want to talk a little bit about workplace culture, where we have some concerns. I want to talk about oversight, and particularly external oversight, or oversight from outside the prisons, of how well they're doing. And I want to talk, lastly, about infrastructure. So that's what I'm going to kind of walk through here in this presentation. But first, let me give a very, very quick overview of the state's prison system. I'm sure most of you know we have 11 different locations, 11 different prison facilities, and they range from level 2, which is the minimum security, up to Oak Park Heights, which is our state's only maximum security facility, correctional facility. And we also have two correctional facilities that serve special populations, the Shakopee prison that houses women, and Red Wing, which is where almost all of our juvenile residents are kept there, are confined. In those prisons, there are about 9,200 prisoners, residents. It varies from day to day. I should note that Minnesota's incarceration rate is lower than that of many other states. In Minnesota, many individuals that have been convicted of crimes are placed in community placements. And so what that means is that those people who are in the state's correctional facilities tend to be those that have been convicted of violent crimes. About 3 out of 4 have been convicted of violent crimes. Providing services and security for those residents are 3,700 staff. The majority of those are security staff, corrections officers and the lieutenants and the people who supervise them. But there are a wide variety of other staff who also provide services in those prisons, including behavioral health staff, medical health staff, educators, industry professionals, food service people, maintenance folks, a lot of different people doing a lot of different jobs in those prisons and coming into daily contact with the people who live there. Now, as I said, I wanted to speak first about concerns about the lack of information. And the question that we were asked to look at is, how safe are the state's prisons? And it is, I'm sorry to say that I have to come to you and say the answer is largely, we don't know. It is difficult to say. And part of that is because the information that is available isn't sufficient to come up with one single answer. The Department of Corrections does not formally measure the safety of its prisons. There's not a score. They aren't 85 out of 100 or something like that. And when you start digging into the information, start digging into the data, you find that the data on violent incidents is poor and difficult to work with. For example, we have a count of the number of prisoners that have been disciplinarily convicted, that is in a process inside the prisons, not convicted in a court of law, but disciplinarily convicted for assault or for fighting. But we have no information in the data for how severe those assaults were, how badly injured was a person. And to be able to get into that type of information, one has to dig into the specifics of each specific incident, and that is just difficult to do across hundreds and hundreds of different incidents. The Department of Corrections has a biennial report, its performance report, that they put out to the legislature and to the public. And we can say that that report undercounts the amount of violence that occurs in prisons because it does not include fights, things that are classified as fights between prisoners. It includes convictions for assaults. And those are two different things in the data. In actuality, either one could be a violent incident in which a person was hurt. And there are 3 times as many individuals that have disciplinary convictions for fights as have convictions for assaults. So overall, the data are poor. And there are, of course, some things that never make it into the reports in the first place. There is violence that occurs in the prisons. Both prisoners and staff told us that there are incidents that are not reported, that are not seen, that we just simply don't know about. But we can say some broad things. Broadly, there is much more violence among prisoners, prisoner against prisoner, than there is violence against staff. And we can also say that the violence among prisoners, broadly speaking, and we get this from looking at several different data sources and seeing that they all agree, that has decreased gradually over the last four fiscal years, as is shown by a chart of one of our sources of data on the slide. That is a good thing, but there still have been some very severe assaults that have taken place between prisoners. One example at one of the prisons we visited was a prisoner who was found by corrections officer staff who was collapsed. And when they went and examined the prisoner, they found out that the prisoner had a punctured lung, which, and that was, not seen at the time that it occurred, but it was discovered afterward and the prisoner was able to get treatment. When we talk about violence against staff, there's, as I said, much less of that than violence among prisoners. But as everyone is aware, that can also be serious or even tragic, as we saw with the two officer deaths in 2018. What we saw in terms of violence against staff in the data, again, from looking at various different sources of data and putting them together, is that we had a spike in violence against staff in calendar year 2018. It was lower beforehand, it went up in 2018, and it went down again. We do not have a good explanation for why that occurred. We examined a number of different suggestions that have been made for why that occurred, and basically we weren't able to give you a conclusive answer, although we would like to do so. And I should point out that this chart that I have up here is a different sort of data. Instead of the disciplinary convictions, instead what I'm showing you here, just to show you that we're looking at different sources of data and trying to put them together, this is workers' compensation claims. And so what you're seeing here is an increase in the number of injuries, people who were paid through workers' compensation for injuries that they sustained on the job because of violent interactions with prisoners. I want to talk about another thing that isn't in the data at all, but we found out about and we thought was quite concerning, and that is sexual offenses against staff by prisoners. And these are particularly offenses against female prisoners. We learned in several of the state's correctional facilities that there are prisoners who expose themselves, who masturbate in front of female staff, who tell them in graphic detail what they want to do with them. And we heard this from staff, but it's hard to see in the data because this type of behavior is often lumped, or I should say is often, it is lumped together with other categories of misconduct. And so I can't give you a count of how often this happens in any way, shape, or form. But it is something that we heard about quite a bit from staff, and particularly from female staff that work in the state's facilities. They also told us that they often do not feel supported by their coworkers or by their supervisors when this does occur, and that there are often instances where prisoners are not appropriately disciplined or otherwise receive consequences for this type of behavior. And that is something that we found concerning, and we do believe that the Department of Corrections does need to do more to support its staff when they encounter these types of incidents. I want to move on to staffing shortages. It's something I know that this committee has talked about. It's something that has been a problem at a number of facilities. There have been particularly acute issues at several prisons, at Stillwater, at Faribault, at Oak Park Heights, but it's been a problem across the department. At the end of fiscal year 2019, Stillwater was 40 staff below its budgeted amount of corrections officer staff. And that's a considerable challenge for administrators and staff to deal with at that facility, and other facilities have problems as well. We cannot give you more detail on that, even though we would like to, because the department does not track. Again, we're coming back to lack of data, does not track the number of staff that any specific prison is short during any specific shift. We would have liked to correlate the staffing shortages, the number of staff in place during specific shifts with the number of incidents that occurred during those shifts, and that's not an analysis that we were able to do because we were not able to get that information. Staffing shortages, many staff told us, affect safety. And there are in a variety of ways. It has to do with the limited ability to monitor prisoners. Staff end up working alone or in much smaller groups than they would prefer when dealing with large numbers of residents. You have increased tensions because prisoners are confined to their cells for longer periods of time because there aren't enough staff to allow them out to do various things. Staff sometimes told us that because they don't have enough time, they have less ability to develop long-term relationships with the prisoners that can pay off further down the line when it's time to calm tensions that come up. And those relationships have been developed. And we heard at a number of correctional facilities that there too often that the facility is running with the bare minimum of individuals available, so that there aren't enough people to deal with sudden crises that come up, and those crises come up on a regular basis. The emergency response teams at facilities are activated about 1 to 3 times a day, depending on the facility. And if you're an officer and you're working in a dining hall with a number of other staff overseeing 100 and some odd prisoners, and then there's an alert, and the other staff are also working on the emergency response team, and they all leave, then you're the officers in alone in that dining facility with a large number of prisoners, and that is not a feeling that is safe for those officers. Staffing, the shortage of staff also affects the ability of the prisons to provide activities for prisoners. Structured activities include things like employment, industrial employment, or education, sexual offender treatment groups, chemical dependency treatment groups, visiting with family and friends, religious services, recreation. And there's pretty good research to suggest that when prisons are able to provide those services to their residents, that you then get less violence in prisons and that you get less recidivism, that offenders are residents are less likely, once they are released, to commit further crimes after they've been released from prison. Staff and prisoners were in agreement that these are important services to provide. In fact, it's probably the one thing that we heard most frequently from prisoners, is that they wanted more of these types of activities. And staff also told us that they, when prisoners have things to do, then they are less likely to end up having increased tensions and getting into conflicts with one another or with staff. However, we aren't able to tell you how often those cancellations occur because of staffing shortages, because once again, there's not enough information available in the data, and we aren't able to correlate those cancellations with violent events that occur. Staffing shortages also lead to heavy overtime use. Officer overtime at state correctional facilities has nearly quadrupled since 2013. Several prisons are routinely forcing officers to work overtime. That is, they are requiring officers at the end of their 8-hour shift to stay at the prison and work another 8-hour shift, or sometimes perhaps a shorter shift. Staff and administrators that we spoke with overwhelmingly agreed that staff that are working large amounts of overtime, and particularly staff that are working large amounts of forced overtime, it affects their job performance. They are not able to be as alert. They are not able to do things as well as they can when they are well rested and they are not tired. So we have a number of recommendations for the Department of Corrections related to staffing. The department certainly should continue its ongoing efforts to improve hiring and retention. It needs to increase the minimum staffing level for shifts so that there are people available for those crises, those unplanned events to occur, because in fact those unplanned events ought to be planned for because they happen all the time. And DOC needs to begin tracking the extent of the staffing shortages on a shift level, on its use of forced overtime, which it does not currently collect, and on how frequently prisoner activities are canceled. I want to move now to talk about a couple of workplace culture issues that we found to be concerning. We asked staff in our survey, is bullying and harassment a problem among staff at your prison? And 1 in 3 staff told us that it was. And those numbers were even higher. It was at 40% for female staff and for African American staff. We thought that was a very disturbingly high number of staff who told us that bullying and harassment among staff, this is not with prisoners, this is just interactions between staff, were a problem at their prison. Some told us some very affecting and difficult to hear stories of harassment and retaliation, either in our interviews at the prisons or in people who separately reached out to us over the course of our evaluation. One officer, for example, described to us a circumstance where they were working in a living unit and called for backup from the emergency response team. The emergency response team said, no, we're not coming, because of their perception that officer had reported on another staff person. Those are stories that are difficult to hear, and those are stories that the Department of Corrections needs to address. Another concern that we had about workplace culture is an overall lack of trust in leadership among frontline staff, among the staff that work on a day-to-day basis with the prisoners. I have here a chart on the slide that shows the responses to a question. We asked, do you agree with the statement that prison administrators do all they can to reduce violence by prisoners against staff? I believe that's on the full chart is on page 43 of the report. I'm suddenly doubting my page number here. So, is that the right one? Yep. No, that's the bullying one. I know. It's in a different. Is it? We'll forget that page number for you. But in any case, we have a large number of staff who disagreed with that statement. Who said, I do not trust the administrators at my facility to make decisions that will support the safety of staff in this prison. As you can see, that percentage at Oak Park Heights that disagreed with that statement was over 60%. The percentage at Rush City was over 50%. And I'm sorry, it's page 75 of the report. I had a feeling that 43 was the wrong page. That's where the full chart is, where you can see the percentages both of agree and disagree. And so that is very concerning as well. Lastly, a thing that we wanted to point out about the culture within Departments of Corrections facilities is that we saw decision-making often not being tied to evidence, that administrators were frequently relying on subjective and informal impressions to make decisions, and that there were often reactions to specific high-profile incidents that were driving changes in practice or in policy. There was not the kind of systematic evaluation of past decisions that we would like to see. We would ask administrators, have you made a change that has affected safety? And they often had a number of examples that they could give. And then we would ask, and so how did you measure whether or not that change made a difference? And often the answer went back to these kind of subjective, informal impressions. Well, we've talked with a lot of people, and we listen a lot, and we pay attention to what we hear, but not in terms of measurement of how many violent events occurred and where did they occur and so forth. And part of that absolutely has to do with the lack of the availability of that data in the first place. Without having that data available, it makes it harder to make decision-making based upon data and information. So we have some recommendations related to workplace culture. The Department of Corrections should take strong actions to address bullying and harassment among its staff and improve communications between administrators and the rank and file. And we encourage the department to move forward toward more systematic, more data-driven decision-making around safety. I have two more parts of my presentation. They're both a little bit shorter. I want to talk a little bit about oversight within the state's prisons, and particularly oversight from outside the prison. And what we found is that there's not a whole lot of systematic oversight from the outside of safety issues in the state prisons. County jails in the state of Minnesota are licensed and inspected by the Department of Corrections and have to meet certain standards that are in Minnesota rules. But that is not true for prisons. For many, many years, it has been the contention of the Department of Corrections that that requirement does not apply to state prisons and it does not license its own prisons, with the exception of the juvenile facility at Red Wing, which falls under some different rules and laws. The Department of Corrections does do voluntarily a process called a security audit, which is kind of a peer review, where individuals from other facilities will all come together and go to a single facility and check out its security procedures. And we thought that those were actually fairly valuable. We read through a number of those, but they do not happen very frequently. The most recent one at St. Cloud was in 2011. The most recent one at Rush City was in 2013. So that's quite a long time between those security audits. And the other thing is that they don't really have teeth. There's no requirement in law or in rule that prisons have to address the recommendations that appear in those security audits. So we have a broad recommendation to the legislature that we think that the legislature ought to put into law requirements that the Department of Corrections have regular external assessments of prison safety using some form of defined standards. And you could do that either by drawing Department of Corrections prisons into the licensure requirements that are in state law already for the county jails, although you might have to change the standards a little bit because they're different types of facilities, or by putting the security audit process into law and perhaps giving it some teeth. Lastly, I want to talk about the infrastructure at two of the state's oldest facilities. St. Cloud and Stillwater, the living units in those facilities are the same living units that have been in place for over 100 years. And those living units create safety challenges that affect the residents that live there and the staff that work there. I have a picture up here on the slide. This is from Stillwater, and it's taken from the vantage point of where officers are stationed on the ground floor of a living unit. And as you can see, the difficulty of keeping track of what's going on in cells that are very far off to the side or up in those tiers higher and higher above is very challenging. There are cameras that staff are able to use to help them with that monitoring, but they do not build prisons this way anymore. And there's a reason they don't build prisons this way anymore. It's because it's challenging to be able to keep track of what's going on in those locations and in those cells. And when there is a fight that is happening in a cell, and maybe it spills out onto the walkway that goes in front of the cell, and now you have prisoners that are fighting with each other 30, 35 feet above a concrete floor with the railing in between. And you have staff that are responding to that fight and that are racing up to those walkways to try and separate those prisoners and to keep everyone as safe as possible with that drop that is just there to the side. It's not the way that prisons are built anymore, and it's not the way that we should be keeping prisoners in the long term. And we have a broad recommendation to the Department of Corrections that we think it's time to begin a conversation about what is the future for these living units at Stillwater and St. Cloud. And we suggest that the Department of Corrections come to the legislature with a long-term plan for rehabilitating or replacing those living units. And we know that that's going to be a difficult conversation because that's a lot of money and it's a lot of organizational challenges in terms of moving residents around while construction is going on. But it's a conversation that we think it's time to start having. And so we make that recommendation to the Department of Corrections. Lastly, I want to come back to the information issue because I keep bringing it up again and again and again, and I wanted to run around to it again. The Department of Corrections needs to transform its data collection processes because, frankly, its data are bad on violent events, it's bad on staffing shortages, it's bad on the use of overtime, it's bad on prisoner participation activities, it's bad on prisoner discipline, it's bad on the use of restrictive housing where prisoners are isolated away from the main population. So the Department of Corrections can't just suddenly start collecting all that data. That's a tremendous job, and they are already short-staffed in their facilities. What the Department of Corrections needs to do is to think about transforming its business practices so that that information is collected along the way and is collected in a way that does not that is easier, in fact, than the current processes of data collection. And then we will have the information that we need to make further recommendations about safety in the years to come. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm done with my presentation, and I guess the commissioner would be next. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kirchner, and Ms. Randall, please stay nearby. We'll hear from the commissioner, and then we'll open up a question and answer for both the Office of Legislative Auditor and our commissioner. Commissioner, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, chairs and joint committee members. My name is Paul Schnell, and I serve as the commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Corrections. I want to first start out by acknowledging and thanking Mr. Nobles, legislative auditor, Ms. Randall, Mr. Kirchner, and the staff from the OLA, who I think did an incredible job on this report. From the very first meeting with the audit team, we pledged our full cooperation. Despite the vulnerability that comes from complete transparency, we viewed the decision by the Legislative Audit Commission as an opportunity to truly learn. When the governor and lieutenant governor placed their trust in me to serve in this role, I committed to do everything I could to work with the DOC staff to improve the safety and security of our prisons for the good and benefit of our state's correctional staff and the people they serve within the agency. After nearly 30 years as a police officer in both urban and suburban communities, I recognize that community safety can only be achieved when the criminal justice system, as a system, meets the needs of the people it serves. The Department of Corrections plays an important role in that system. Our responsibility at the department is to transform lives, to make communities and neighborhoods, both large and small, safer over the long term. We serve the people of Minnesota by supervising, securing, and addressing the needs of system-involved people. This OLA, program evaluation, is an important means of doubling down on our commitment to safety. Today I'm joined by the wardens of our correctional facilities, along with the directors of the DOC's Office of Professional Accountability, Office of Special Investigations, our finance and data and technology unit directors. Also here are our deputy commissioners, assistant commissioners, communications and government relations director. While I'm honored to serve as this agency's commissioner, let there be no doubt it is our staff who come to work every single day and who provide the opportunity for lives to be transformed. Our state is fortunate to have so many talented and committed people doing the work to make us all more safe. It would be remiss if I didn't mention the loss of officers Gom and Parisi, whose loss had a profound impact on the Department of Corrections. It is incumbent upon all of us to honor their service and sacrifice by making and taking every reasonable action to ensure the safety and well-being of all our staff, along with the people they serve. A career in corrections is not easy, but for those committed to public service, the reward can be immense. The OLA's report confirmed our own assessment as to the state of the Department of Correction, which our leadership team and I developed over the last year during hundreds of hours of facility visits and talking with our new colleagues and hearing their concerns. The report highlights troubling realities. I accept the findings and recommendations in whole because they reflect reality. And I recognize that defensiveness, blame lane, and minimization won't make correctional facilities safer. We view this as an opportunity to rally DOC staff and our fellow Minnesotans around our new and common mission to transform lives for a safer Minnesota. To do this, we must accept the findings gleaned by the OLA report as informed by our staff and the people we serve. We know that improving prison safety and providing effective correctional services are not mutually exclusive. Safe prisons create environments for the delivery of transformative correctional service, and effective services promote safe prisons and safe communities. In response to the OLA's findings and recommendations, we plan to establish working groups to develop operational plans around each of the recommendations offered by the OLA. Incorporated into our plan will be the progress we've made over the last 14 months on a number of critical initiatives, including the creation of a comprehensive agency strategic plan that will guide the DOC's work over the next 3 years. This plan was informed and developed in consultation with more than 500 staff throughout the DOC, along with stakeholders and others in the community. Second, the establishment of the DOC's Office of Professional Accountability to support professional accountability within the agency and serve as an independent office to investigate issues or concerns related to sexual harassment and other unacceptable behavior. The establishment of the Office of Peer Support, an area of interest to the Corrections Committee, to provide immediate post-critical incident services and responsive support for all of our staff, including our female staff who bear the inordinate and disparate impact of sexual harassment. Identification of new data collection systems along with needed process changes, overhauling new employee onboarding, training academy, and the enculturation process, an expansion of our tools to address inmate misconduct, while minimizing the use of lockdowns that negatively impact whole units within a facility. I'd like to touch on a couple of items specifically mentioned in the report. We recognize more than ever the need for us as an agency to address the challenge of being what I say is called data-rich but information-poor. As I said in my response letter, we want to develop the Minnesota Department of Corrections into a national leader around data-driven safety and security practices. We must use data to inform and assess the impact of agency efforts in real time. We endeavor the creation of systems that allow for the ongoing measurement of correctional facility safety, the ability of those we serve to access transformative programming and services, the effectiveness of our disciplinary interventions, and progress around staff recruitment, retention, and training. We will step up our efforts around to improve communications with both our staff and stakeholders. And as it relates to hiring, we believe the recent contract settlement with the Correctional Officers Union will dramatically help us toward that end. Some of the hardest information to read in the report was the feedback received from our women colleagues who experience sexual harassment and are, more frequently than their male counterparts, exposed to sexual misconduct. Similarly, the concerns raised with regard to a culture of bullying, harassment, and retaliation among and between staff at all levels must be recognized for the negative impact on our mission. To the women serving in the DOC whose sexual harassment and exposure to indecent sexual conduct in our prisons was dismissed and minimized, and to the DOC staff who were subjected to bullying, harassment, and or retaliation, I tell you I am sorry. And I'm committed to changing that. If we endeavor to transform the lives of those in our prisons, we must also model and expect respectful treatment of each other. Harassment, bullying, abuse, retaliation are contrary to the principles of respect for human dignity and a commitment to civility and have no place in our communities, much less our workplaces. As I close, I want to remind you of something I've said many times over the past year. 95% of the people in Minnesota's prisons will one day get out. They will live in cities, small towns, and rural communities across our state. When they do come out, our state's collective interest is for them to come out successfully, to be pro-social contributing members of our communities. We want them to be good neighbors. Improving the likelihood of success for people in the system is not a pipe dream. It most certainly demands a focus of change for those in the system, in our prisons, but it also requires some change on our part. Nearly every organized religion calls believers to recognize the possibility of redemption. And yet as a society, we struggle with trying to determine when a person's punishment is complete, how they become whole. If we want the people to leave our prisons as good neighbors, we must do all we can to have the services we provide lead to the development of good neighbors. To my 4,300 DOC colleagues who will watch this recording, the recording of this hearing, I say this. I have every confidence in you and this agency's ability to not only deliver on the recommendations contained in the OLA report, but to make the Department of Corrections both a great place to work and a national model for transformative service delivery. Chairs and committee members, I look forward to working with you on the issues identified in the report, and I thank you for the opportunity to provide a comment. And I, along with the OLA staff, will stand for any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Commissioner. There are a number of questions. For sure, I have several, but let me just make some quick, very quick observations, and I'll ask a question or two. One is I want to express my appreciation to the spirit of openness and ownership and the verbal public commitment to change that you just made, that you've demonstrated prior to this and at this hearing as well. I look forward, as I suspect my colleagues on all sides of the aisle here are as well. I look forward to working with you on a very big and vitally important issue. So thank you for that. I do also want to express my gratitude to the Office of Legislative Auditor, and we do have our Legislative Auditor here, Mr. Noble. It's been one of my distinct privileges to have served with you for so many years. Thank you for the objective, thorough, open-eyed work that you provided to this legislative body. I do want to acknowledge our wardens. I'm just wondering if maybe, if they're here in the room, maybe they can just stand so everyone knows who you are. I haven't met you all, but welcome. Thank you. I've met some of you, and it's good to see you here today. Thank you. Thank you for the work that you do. And then I also want to acknowledge our brand-new ombudsperson for corrections, Mr. Mark Hossie. There he is. I was told you were here, but I couldn't find you. Welcome, sir. Your work, and your staff here as well? All general staff, but let me just hold on. I just to comment, your office, no doubt, is going to have to play a pretty big role the coming months and years relative to this agenda. Please let us know how this body can assist you in that work. Thank you, Commissioner, for taking the lead along with Chair Considine to bring us back this office. And as the Chair pointed out, we also have staff here, and I suspect that's quite a few folks from our facilities. I'm not sure who's all here, but I suspect
a couple in uniform.
Correction officers, and welcome. Thank you for your work. So I also do want to acknowledge that when I had the briefing with the Office of Legislative Auditor, that the staff made it a point to point out the level of strong cooperation from the department relative to their inquiry. We have great state departments in this state. I don't think there's an office that doesn't cooperate strongly. But for me, having been around many years, just to hear the level of earnestness relative to the cooperation rendered by the office was a very telling piece of information. Let me ask a couple questions very quickly, then I'll open it up. Actually, my first question is back to you, Mr. Kirshner and Ms. Randall. When we met, I had raised the issue of training. And so I'm wondering if you can just share, just quickly, what you shared with me back then and anything else that's salient relative to the issue of staff training relative to safety.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. There is a lot in our report, and I had to leave a number of things out of the presentation. But one thing I should not have left out of the presentation, if you'll indulge me, is I did not introduce the other members of the team that worked on this evaluation. It is a team effort, and I want to acknowledge Caitlin Zanoni and Tavis Layton, who are sitting behind me, for their strong work on this evaluation. With regard to training, We did ask staff about training, and we heard from staff across the board that they want more. And specifically, there are two things that we heard. One is that there's a strong desire that non-uniform staff, that is staff who are not corrections officers, have the opportunity to have self-defense training on a regular basis. And I shouldn't say the opportunity, but they should be required to have it on a regular basis. Currently, they have that training when they first go through their orientation at the very beginning of their careers at the Department of Corrections, but then they are not required to see that retraining again. A lot of them, it's been many years since they've had that training. And so there's strong support across the board for those non-uniform staff to have self-defense training on a regular basis. The other thing is that corrections officers told us that they do not feel they receive training frequently enough on the core trainings that they need in order to prepare to deal with violent conflicts between prisoners or when prisoners assault staff. Those are incredibly important skills because you have to have them ready and be able to use them at a moment's notice and sometimes very unexpectedly. And having those trainings occur frequently helps to keep those skills very sharp. Right now, the process is you receive a refresher on those trainings every 2 years, and staff thought that that was not frequent enough, and they really strongly wanted to have those trainings much more frequently. So it is one of our other recommendations in the report is that the department look to increase the frequency of its training for staff and how they deal with violent conflicts.
Thank you, Mr. Kirschner. And that makes intuitive sense to me, particularly as I interact with law enforcement and security personnel, to be able to have a full array of tools available, especially when confronted with a violent or potentially violent situation, so that we don't inadvertently, for instance, wind up escalating a situation. And it seems to me that that is something that we have to constantly go back to the well of replenishing our thoughts and our knowledge and our practices. Thank you for that. Commissioner, my question, I have many, but one very issue that really captured me right away was this painting a picture of a, as you put, as you described, data-rich, information-poor environment. And you opened up by talking about systems. And I think many of us, I do, you know, wrestle with what we need to do to cultivate and tend and arm, equip systems in addition to what we need to do with individuals. And of course, those are not, you know, completely separable, but data is one way in which systems can be shaped and reshaped and redesigned to reinforce individual behavior. And so the Office of Legislative Auditor talked about critical decisions that are heavily made based on subjective experiences, which are important, however, not often made based on objective analysis of data. So this could be a really long answer, but just, you know, we'll have more of this to come, no doubt, in both Chair Considine's committee and in future hearings. But what models can we draw from that you would be looking for in terms of, and these are my words, you tell me if I'm wrong, redesigning our data culture and mechanisms at the Department of Corrections. Are there models out there? I'm told, quite frankly, that this department is not alone relative to this issue, relative to other states. We often look to other states, just to borrow ideas and adapt them. But just very quickly, you know, what are your thoughts initially relative to this big, I think what's going to be a big turning relative to the issue of being a much more modernly data-centered department.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think, you know, we certainly agree with Wally's finding here. We know that the systems we use are disparate, in some cases paper, which makes the management of data much more difficult. As we think about what the systems need to be, is what we want to make sure that we're developing systems that we are not having multiple inputs. People are doing different things at different times, that all of our facilities are using consistent practices so that we can make generalizations about what's happening both within a given facility, yet and as well across our agency. And I think as we think about, as we've been having some conversations since getting the initial kind of draft of the report a short time ago, we started to talk about the fact that these information systems need to both inform what happens within our prisons, but ultimately the system's response and the management of these people throughout their involvement with the system. And this could be a benefit to the counties, it could be a benefit across the board. And so I think there are some, as we think about what this looks like, we have some need to move more immediately to address some of the immediate needs and consistency of how we collect, manage, and process this data. And that may include changes to our work processes. But we also want to make sure we are thinking big in terms of creating data and information systems that really benefit the system from the time somebody enters the criminal justice process all the way through supervision and ultimately their discharge.
And Commissioner, I'll ask one last question, and I'll just open up for others. This is really a broad question, which is, as you look at the report, is there anything or are there things in the report that surprised you as commissioner?
Mr. Chair, I would just say that, you know, certainly, as I pointed out, I think some of the information about the individual impact, and when we met with the audit team, I think one of the things that we learned just from them and the practice of bringing together our women correctional officers and the information that was learned from that. And we think there's some opportunities for us to bring different groups of people, officers together, because I think we have to recognize the experience of working in our facility is different for different people, whether it's across gender or race or any number of different factors that could be present. And we think there was some there's valuable learning there.
Very well. Thank you, Commissioner. Chair Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I'm listening to this in preliminary, it appears to me that we need a cultural shift within the DOC. We need to view the custody staff as a state resource, and they need to be brought in the decision-making, team-building. The three things that I found the most troubling in this, two of them I expected to hear, that they felt left out in the decision-making, they weren't being heard. I'm sorry, two of them I was a little surprised about. The bullying, that needs to stop. Again, these people not only are our front line for security, but they're also the people that interact daily with the residents of the prison. They're the ones that actually are going to make the most significant impact on changing their behavior. And we need to be giving them the support that they need. The sexual harassment of female officers is just unacceptable. And I'm hearing you say that you're working on that. But that was the one that surprised me, that was quite so prevalent and was going basically ignored. But we have to support these people. I'm glad you brought up the peer-to-peer. They need help in mental health. They need help, but they need to be brought into the decision-making and the process so that they feel like they're being heard, because they're the people that are going to impact our residents the most, and they have to be role models. They have to be teachers, and they have to be comfortable where they are and safe. I was also very happy that the safety concerns were rolled a little bit together. Because the staff aren't safe, the folks that are living there aren't going to be safe either. So there are some cultural shifts that we need to do, but I think that starts with looking at the line staff as a resource that has been underutilized and needs to be brought into the picture. Thank you.
Commissioner, I suspect the work groups that you've identified as part of a big response will offer opportunities for that kind of broad participation and equal ownership of problem solving.
Mr. Chair, absolutely. And you know, even since the report is out, we've had some conversations with AFSCME leadership, as a for instance, in the facilities about the opportunity for us to work together on some things that we have mutual interest in making sure our workforce is supported. Both the unions and the department are committed to working together to make that happen.
Very well. We have questions from Representative Tapke and Representative Wogelbaum. Representative Tapke.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I am I'm the representative for Shakopee, where the women's prison is, and I have a couple questions. I've had the opportunity to tour many of the correctional facilities across the state, and thank you very much for putting this together. Thank you to the Department of Corrections for their work in helping to get this information out. And as I've toured, one of the main concerns that I really have is the staffing shortages side of things and the safety consequences of that. And one of, as I talked to CEOs and talked to different folks, there's considerable concern around the centralized hiring portion of things and how that is affecting the ability for each individual facility across the state to manage hiring and get the staffing that they need. To both OLA and DOC, has that come up in your findings and what you discussed with folks, the centralized hiring, and if so or if not, what is happening to improve the hiring processes?
Mr. Kirshner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm actually going to pitch that over to the Department of Corrections in part because we had our hands full looking at safety in the facilities themselves, and we did not spend a whole lot of time looking at the hiring process, although we acknowledge that it's a significant concern.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Jaffke. I think you raised, I think, a great point about localized hiring options, and we've done some experimentation with that, and we've had some success. We think that is one of the things that is being worked on right now is to be able to decentralize some of that hiring and move that out to the facilities. I would say that despite the fact that we have had success there, we've been able to hire a good number of officers. Where we've struggled is an equal number, almost one for one, going out the back door. And that is due to retirement and other challenges that we've faced. Some of that reflected very much in the report, the forced overtime, the difficulty in some of the environment stuff, as well as I think just the fact that, you know, we've had a lot of conversations about the safety and security of our prisons, and so that itself, I'm certain, has an impact on us attracting candidates. But I do believe that we have the ability to do it. I think these are, as Chair Considine pointed out, these are meaningful roles. And I think being able to do that on a more localized level would make a difference, and it's something that we want to institutionalize at a much larger rate.
Representative Tapke, you have a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as a follow-up to that, with the Shakopee facility being the state's only women's facility, did you find, as you were going through, any findings, any things that were specific to the safety of both the correctional officers and the inmates as well? There have been multiple incidences over the last year, specifically at the Shakopee facility. Did you find anything there that needs to change specific to the women's facility, or are you comfortable with how things are going? Because there's not as much of a staffing shortage there in that facility, and so just wondering what you found specific to Shakopee.
Mr. Kirchner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do not have a whole lot of findings in the report specific to Shakopee, and that's partly because of a decision that we made early on that our understanding is that the strongest concerns were at the level 4 and level 5 men's facilities, and that was where we spent most of our time in terms of talking to individuals. So we had shorter visits at the minimum security facilities at Shakopee and at Red Wing. And so we have fewer specific findings for those particular facilities. I will note, however, that there are a number of different charts in the report where we break down information by prison, and you can see how Shakopee ranks up against the other prisons on a variety of the different things that we looked at, particularly in terms of the responses to the survey, but in some other places as well. And we also, if I recall correctly, in a couple of the exhibits that involve the surveys of prisoners, we broke out Shakopee, specifically those prisoners' responses, because we felt that they had a different experience than the prisoners that were in the men's facilities. And so I direct you to look at there are a number of places in the report where you will see some specific things. But broadly speaking, we spent a lot more time at Oak Park Heights, Rush City, St. Cloud, and Stillwater.
And, you know, Commissioner, this opens up, in my mind, this question around our auditing process and the security audits that are currently being used. I was struck that apparently no security audit had been done since 2011, and it sounds like they don't happen very often. this also can be the topic of a long conversation, and will be. But just very quickly, your reaction and response to openness relative to modernizing our auditing process of our state prison facilities.
Mr. Chair, I think in general, my response would be that I do think that there is some benefit to saying if we're going to create a standard that we're going to apply to counties who provide correctional services across our state, that we should, in general, there may be some differences just based upon the length of stay and those sorts of things that would happen in a prison. We should apply that standard to ourselves. I would also just add that we had, the agency had moved toward ACA accreditation. I think the report talks about this, American Correctional Association. And we went through accreditation, creating standards. But one of the things that we found was that process really became overwhelming and was itself consuming a lot of staff time to the point where it pulls staff from being able to do their day-to-day work. And so how do we create a mechanism that assures compliance with a reasonable standard? And we think that some type of licensing mechanism, having the licensing staff who are independent and not in our facilities work on and create, whether it's through rulemaking or by legislation, the creation of specific standards, and have that body ensure that gets done, that those could all be reasonable and viable options, and certainly things that we would support.
Commissioner, I look forward to that work, and you just motivated me to try to bend Chair Considine's arm to reverse his decision, because we would certainly benefit from your experience and guidance relative to that issue. Representative Wolgamott?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And then Representative Lemieux.
My question is for the Office of Legislative Auditor. I'm proud to serve the brave men and women who work at the St. Cloud Correctional Facility, and our whole community felt the pain of the spike in violence against staff that took place in 2018. So I was really frustrated and disappointed to hear today that you didn't really have any causes or any conclusions on what caused that spike. And so, Mr. Kershaw, I was wondering if you could explain to me and to the committee how you reached that conclusion, that there were no causes for it, and if you have any educated explanations for what caused this spike in violence against our staff.
Mr. Kershaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Wolgamott. I agree that it is very frustrating. And one of the things that is the most puzzling about the spike in violence against staff that happened in 2018 is we did not see a corresponding spike in violence among prisoners. And most of the explanations that one might look at as being something that would explain, you know, if you have this, then you have more violence, you would expect to also see an increase in violence that's occurring among prisoners, because we know that much more violence occurs between prisoners than occurs against staff. And so having that, you know, as you saw, a very kind of almost straight line, slightly downward trend in terms of violence against prisoners, and then you have this, you know, this spike that happens with regard to violence against staff, it is puzzling. And it makes it hard to come up with anything that, you know, we looked at a number of things that people have raised, and some of them we couldn't test because the data weren't there. As I said, we wanted to look at, you know, does this happen more often when shifts are short of staff? And we couldn't quite get at that. Does it work more often when there are more staff that are forced to work overtime? Again, the Department of Corrections does not distinguish between voluntary and forced overtime in its data, so we couldn't look at that. So there are a number of things we could not look at. But even if we had been able to look at some of those things, we still would have had the puzzle of trying to figure out why it only made a difference with regard to violence that occurred against staff and didn't make a difference with regard to violence that occurs among prisoners. And that, frankly, is a puzzle to us. And we don't have, and that, that, and, but we also wanted to point out that, you know, that we did spend a lot of time looking at various possibilities and did not come up with anything. And I'm happy to talk about specific things, as I said. Another thing that we looked at were changes in the rules regarding restrictive housing. That is, when prisoners are placed in segregated settings away from other prisoners. And there were changes in those rules that took place. But again, if that were an explanation, we would have expected to see that it would have affected violence against prisoners as well as violence against staff, because the penalties are the same. I mean, different degrees of penalty, but it's the same issue, the same form of penalty both ways, and it you would have expected to see a difference. So I'm sorry that I don't have a better explanation. I wish I did.
Yeah. Follow-up. One more question, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you for that answer, and it's good to see this chart that the spike is lessening. But there are still assaults that are happening. In fact, in St. Cloud, just within the past month, we had another staff and another assault on an officer. So this is still of deep concern to me and to my community. So I wanted to ask if there are any data showing a link between increased discipline and a decrease in staff or inmate assault.
Mr. Kirch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We looked at that quite extensively because it has been a theory that has been out there as part of the public conversation, and we did not find the conclusive evidence tying those two together. And I started to talk about this, but I'm happy to speak more about it. There was a change at the Department of Corrections in terms of the penalties that were applied to prisoners that assaulted one another or that assaulted staff, and that change took place in 2016. But as I said, that change occurred for both types of offenses, right? Both violence against staff and violence against prisoners. And then you do have a spike that happens, but it's 2 years after the change in those penalties. And then the spike declines again before the Department of Corrections moved this year to increase penalties once again for the most violent incidents. So the timing doesn't work very well to use that as an explanation. And as I said, the other thing that is challenging with that as an explanation is you would think that if that was a good explanation for the spike in violence against staff, you would have also seen a spike in violence among prisoners, because those penalties were reduced for both types of offenses, and we didn't see that. So that makes it challenging for that to be an explanation. It is possible to come up with a carefully convoluted story that would explain the spike, but it would be speculation, and I wouldn't present it with any confidence that it would then make sense for the next time that violence suddenly declines or suddenly increases, because it would have just been, kind of a convoluted attempt to put together what we have available.
A good argument for the state of conversation.
Absolutely,
Mr. Chair. Representative Walkerman, very briefly.
Yeah, absolutely. More of a comment. I want to thank the commissioner and the department and our warden, Eddie Miles. Since becoming vice chair of the subcommittee, I've been out to our St. Cloud Correctional Facility multiple times and have seen firsthand the vehement need for a long-term plan for the rehabilitation or replacement of our very dated facility. So I just want to express my willingness and my eagerness to partner with you on that and advancing that through the legislature to make sure that we have a safe infrastructure at the St. Cloud Correctional Facility. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Walgamon. Representative O'Neill and then Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I really feel like we are at an absolute crisis here in the DOC. We're at a breaking point, and I am so glad that we have corrections officers in the back row, because I think they are taking the brunt of this. They are at a breaking point. They're forced overtime. I mean, four times as much forced overtime or voluntary overtime. I think it doesn't really matter if it's voluntary or forced. Since 2013, they are at their breaking point. And, you got to stop the bleeding. Yeah, we can look at data, we can look at this, we can look at that, but right now we need to stop the bleeding. I know that we as a body have supported in a budgetary way, but there's got to be more that we can do. I know there's folks in the back row over there that probably have some solutions. There's some union representation back there. But right now, we've got to stem the bleeding. So the first thing I want to hear is what is the plan to mitigate some of this overtime, whether it be forced or voluntary? To me, it doesn't seem to matter. When you're working 16 hours a day in that kind of environment, working on 3 or 4 hours sleep, what do you think is going to happen? Not good things. And we could talk about data and causations all day long. But right now, I think we need to talk about how are we going to get these corrections officers some relief. That's what I want to hear. And that needs to happen now. Not in a year from now, not 2 years from now, now. I'm not willing to wait. So whatever we need to do, it needs to happen right now. And, of course, it's in our 4 and 5 level, the most stressful prisons, that's where they're at their breaking point. So that's what I want to hear from the commissioner. What are we going to do right here, right now, to give some relief to the poor corrections officers that are working 16-hour days on 3 or 4 hours sleep, day after day after day? What are we doing right now?
Commissioner, we've had some of this conversation in prior hearings, but please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Neal, I feel that same sense of urgency. I think you know that from the conversations we've had. I will also tell you that if I could wave a wand and fix this, I would do it in a second. This is a complicated issue because one thing has implications on the next. We had issues around our competitiveness, which I believe is fully addressed and implemented. That new contract is out. We're hiring at a higher rate. We think that that will help us stabilize relative to competitiveness with both other DOCs, neighboring DOCs, but even in the metro. We're still we're really more in line now with being able to attract at the beginning. And in that first year or two, we were losing people at high rates to county facilities. We honestly believe this is going to help. We don't believe it's the whole answer. We could lock down our prisons, and we could put the men and women who are in our correctional facilities in cells and lock them in there and keep them in there until and unless there's adequate staff to move them out. But even our staff will say that that's not a good solution. I think this is going to require, and I think just the attention on this issue, I think, is going to ultimately help. There are people out there we know who have a heart and a soul and a commitment to making a difference with these people. And what we need to do is get folks in the door who are committed and want to serve in the capacity. We are trying to, our wardens, I will tell you, we have regular conversations about how do they try to keep down overtime and forcing overtime, and at the same time not try to close programs. At the same time, we also know I feel horrible for our staff because if I know that I'm going to be forced and it's my kid's birthday and I need to be home, I can tell you what's going to happen on Saturday when I'm supposed to work that shift. I'm likely to call in sick because that's the only way I'm going to get off. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to think about the systemic nature of this. And certainly, as we've done our strategic planning, we have engaged in unprecedented levels of conversation. And I will tell you, beyond the receiving end of those, from not so happy people and their family members, and I respect that. I'm responsible to make sure that we're moving forward. And while we whether it's been on the union and management labor front, we haven't always agreed, but I can tell you that together we're committed to making a difference, because our staff know we can't just lock people in and we can't just continue to force people on overtime because it's not a sustainable solution. We are looking at the full range of other options, looking at how do we manage the short-term people that are coming into our facilities and are creating massive amounts of churn and ultimately impact the stability of the environments. These are some things that we can actually begin to do to make a difference by removing some of these folks. And we've been talking with our Community Corrections Act partners and our agents across the state, and there is mechanisms for us to manage those folks in the community in a safe way and reduce population. And we think that these things are all viable and legitimate and are actively being planned for. So I want to just be really clear that I share that strong sense of urgency that you communicated, and that I'm committed to making sure we get there. And I know from my conversations with AFSCME leadership that they are as well. And the only way we're going to get there is together. That's what I can tell you, and the direction we're moving. And I have every confidence we'll get there.
Commissioner, you certainly hear, I would argue, a strong passion on all sides of the aisle in this body relative to these big questions, particularly the stress on our human personnel. I'm struck, Chair Considine, that Minnesota legislature in over 100 years had never stepped foot officially into one of our facilities until your committee did that. And what we signaled both to our staff, our COs, to our residents in those facilities is that we're going to approach things differently here. That you matter, and that the disinterest, the looking the other way, that's long, unfortunately, been a part of this institution, that's over. And so I look forward to strong work going forward. Representative Christensen and then Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is probably for the commissioner. But first of all, I just want to share Representative O'Neill's. When I heard about, especially forced overtime, it's unfathomable to me. We as legislators sometimes have to stay here until midnight or 1 in the morning, and it gets, it's hard on a body. It's hard on a human being. It's hard on emotions. It's hard on a lot of things. So this is just a statement, but I so agree that I just can't even believe that they have to do that, especially under the circumstances that they work. So, I agree that I think that, and staffing, we talked about it. Staffing's a problem. So, you know, who wants to do that? Who wants to take a job where they have to do that? So that's a statement. I think the sexual harassment, sexual violence, bullying, sexual bullying, especially to female staff, is important, is disturbing, but I think in all of our hearts is probably not surprising. So it's just, I think it's a culture thing that we need to do now to really, really look at that and look at it for what it is. And also to include in there, resident, you know, between themselves, sexual harassment, sexual bullying, sexual violence between residents. That's an important thing that we need to look at too. And then I realize we're getting close here, but I'm in Stillwater, and our building in Stillwater also is old. And so I was going to make this a question, but I'm going to make it a statement, and I would like to work with you, as Representative Wolgamott said, that I'm very interested in infrastructure plans and what that would look like and what that's going to do for our facility, not only in Stillwater, but just the DOC in general. So thank you very much. Very, very informative and interesting findings that we've got here, and I think it's the starting point for a lot of good things to happen. So thanks so much.
And I suspect, Commissioner, that first of all, I know building prisons or rehabilitating prisons is not a cheap thing, and I suspect that the politics are not good to step forward on something like that, regardless of what party one is from. History speaks for itself. When I first stepped into Stillwater many years ago, then several years later, I saw the movie Shawshank Redemption. I could have sworn they filmed it, over at Stillwater. And when I visited most recently, I was struck by being at the end of a long hallway and feeling very far away from knowing what the heck is going on in the immediate vicinity. And so the challenges that we face, it seems to me, are big not only in terms of what exists, but what we are probably morally and from the point of view of safety even, just that, called to do. And I think that's to have a different physical construct in which we have our residents. It's going to take a lot of courage. It's going to take a lot of us building trust across the aisle with one another if we're going to move forward with a bold vision for a humane and safe physical construct to replace these facilities. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, I would just say I couldn't agree more. I think we have had, as among wardens and DOC leadership, conversations even about ways to think about this over the long haul that isn't going to result in the building of a brand new prison at a cost of $300 to $600 million. We believe that there are some things that we can do to maximize even the use of these really old facilities. By thinking about classification, by thinking about what we do there, there's some opportunities. And we look forward to working with the legislature to talk through what that could look like.
Look forward to that. We have, I'm sorry, why did they make these mics so short? I can't lean back and relax a bit. So we're almost at our end. We do have Representative Johnson and Representative O'Neill, I think, wanted to come back on a point. I'm willing to go a few minutes beyond. There is another committee that's coming in, so I want to make sure that we're good for them. So let's set ourselves for about 20 after and see where we're at that point. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, first of all, I would like to thank the corrections officers that are here. The work you do is very valuable to this state, and going through this report, I apologize from the state for what you've had to go through. This report does not paint a very good picture of what's happening in our correction system. Commissioner Snell, I believe you have a lot of work to do. The one thing I noticed between from Stillwater, which is about a 35% lack of trust in leadership, to Oak Park Heights, where it's 63% lack of trust of the leadership, you have your hands full. Need to really take a good look at what's going on. The non-support of the staff by the supervisors is unacceptable. Those guys over there are wonderful. They need to be treated respectfully. The abuse that they've taken, and I'm not hearing it's not only from the prisoners, sometimes it's from other staff, and nothing's being done. And I hope those supervisors that are supposed to take care of that are held accountable. We have had a talk about the spike in 2017, where we went up over, for the second time, over 100 assaults on staff. But what we haven't talked about at all is in this last half of biennium, we're at 104. We're at a pace of over 200, close to 210 assaults on staff this biennium. We need to end that. We need to end it now. How we do that, that is up to you and your staff to figure out how to do that. As a legislature, we don't micromanage your departments. But I can say this, this in the past, this decisions that was made, and it's right in the report, that there was never an evaluation of those decisions as were they effective or not. We need to start taking a look at the decisions we make. Are they effective? Are they not? To make sure that each one of those staff members goes home at night, that they're not spending the night in the hospital or making a trip to ER because they were assaulted. I'll do whatever I can to help you. but we need to get this done. We need to get done now. We can't wait any longer.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative O'Neill, you get our last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very briefly, I just wanted to stand up for all of the female corrections officers that were encountering all kinds of sexual harassment and worse. And I just want to make a statement that if you tolerate it, it'll continue. So I hope that you move forward with a no-tolerant policy where if a inmate is doing those sexual things to or in front of or whatever, a female officer in particular, because that's their target, that they that there are repercussions for that. Because I think whatever you tolerate, that behavior will continue. So I would ask you on behalf of all the female corrections officers that have endured that in particular. There hasn't been that voice yet, so I wanted to make sure that was said. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, I apologize for that on behalf of myself and our department, and I will make every commitment to make sure that that gets wholly addressed. I just want to provide one clarification. I think assault data information that Representative Johnson, we have some difference in some of these assault numbers, and I think we have to be really careful about how we categorize things as assault. As we talked about in one of the previous committee meetings, anything that happens relative to our staff is unacceptable, but as we talked about, there is this continuum of experiences. Somebody can be spit on, which is always unacceptable, but it is a very different experience, and our response to that, depending upon if that spittle gets on a person's pants versus on a part of their skin or their face, those things really do make a difference. We have to look at this across the continuum and reject all of it, but be proportional in our response.
Very well. Members, we are near the end here. I want to thank the Office of Legislative Auditor for producing, I think, a very, perhaps at times, difficult report to produce, but your perseverance and commitment to good public service allows you to put forward a very strong report that we can dig deep into and that can drive a sense of urgency on the part of the legislature, as we heard recently from several members. I want to also acknowledge our wardens for the difficult work that you do, for our COs and our staff who are present, as well as to our ombudspersons. It's going to take all of us pulling together on this. Again, I want to reiterate that I'm really proud of the work that this committee did last year in taking seriously the need to invest in these facilities, and more importantly, or just as importantly, in the people who work in them. I wish I could say that same sense of urgency was emanated from the other body, but it didn't. However, it took a strong House to pull them in the right direction. We hope that those resources, Commissioner, will be used wisely in the coming months and year to answer part of these questions, and then we look forward to the other things that the department needs from us. In order to turn our prisons into good, safe, humane, dignified places that advance our philosophy of corrections and makes us a leader in the nation. So with that, members, we will reconvene tomorrow. We're going to have conversation under the broad banner of redemption. It should be a very rich conversation in action. I want to thank everyone for being here today. And Chair Considine, I adjourn our joint committee here.